Welcome back to EVR 2858. We are now looking at the Clean Water Act, which there's so much in this, we're now in part one. By the end of this lecture, you should be able to describe what constitutional provision Congress used to pass the CWA, the four important principles of the 1972 amendments, the federal and state terminology related to water, what a source is as defined by federal law, the Florida's total maximum daily load limits and cost concerns, and how Florida attempts to use alternatives to regulatory permitting. Before I get into the meat of the Clean Water Act, I need to point out something that you may think of as odd. Environmental laws are in place to protect humans and other creatures in nature from polluting human impacts. Until President Richard Nixon signed the National Environmental Policy Act into law on January 1, 1970, there was nothing saying that we, the people, had the right to a clean environment. It says nothing in the U.S. Constitution about having the right to breathe clean air, to drink clean water, and to have uncontaminated soil to grow food crops. As we go through these laws, you are going to see that the limits in the laws and regulations are not what the scientific community came up with. What do I mean? There is a difference between scientific studies, the law, and governmental policy. Let's look at this for just a minute. From Wikipedia, yes, I know, we learned two things. And I will tell you 1,000 times over never to trust Wikipedia as an academic source, but this gives a most succinct review to make this short and to the point. First, policy can be defined as a course of action or principle adopted or proposed by a government, party, business, or individual. And this is the 1995 Oxford Dictionary. That is, policy is the interpretation and operational application of laws. A given law may have multiple different and/or competing interpretations. These interpretations may come about as a result of different political approaches to governing or different environmental policies. We will discuss some of these over the course of the semester. Second, our course will examine some of the major environmental laws, such as the Clean Water Act and the Clean Air Act. The implementation of some of the nuances of an environmental law, such as environmental issues related to air and water pollution, waste management, ecosystem management, biodiversity protection, the protection of natural resources, wildlife and endangered species, and the preservation of these natural resources for future generations, involves the implementation of environmental policies. Also, the scientific recommendations on limits of chemicals and compounds humans should be exposed to are universally not the limits contained within these laws and regulations. Why not? Because now we get into politics. Politicians have multiple constituencies, and it is necessary to balance the pros and cons for each constituency against the whole of the constituency. Hopefully, this brief explanation of laws, policy, and politics will be helpful as we go through this semester. Now, as I have introduced, we had no right to clean water until the Federal Water Pollution Control Act was enacted. This federal law established a floor, i.e., the most minimum standards states had to establish in order to abide by the federal statutes. Now, hold on, you say. What about the 10th Amendment? If the U.S. Constitution says nothing about clean water, how can the federal government force states to clean their water? Even though there is nothing in the Constitution that specifically says the federal government can legislate for clean water, there is the Commerce Clause. The Commerce Clause in Article 1, Section 8, Clause 3 says Congress has the power to regulate commerce with foreign nations and among the several states and the Indian tribes. Why are we looking at business transactions here? Commerce is not defined in the Constitution, but it has been interpreted to be more than just trade or exchange. If a state puts laws in place that makes items from other states more expensive than those made within the state, that impacts commerce between the states, and the feds can step in. It is to level the playing field. There is what is called the race to the bottom. If left to their own devices, states will reduce environmental limits to attract businesses to the detriment of states that have stricter environmental limits. This has been repeatedly shown to be true in the past. An upriver state allows pollution to be dumped into their rivers, and then it travels to a downriver state that is highly impacted from that pollution. An example of this is if an upriver state sites a lot of manufacturing facilities close to the state border in order to prevent the upriver state from getting impacted from dumping in the river. But the downriver state suffers from the deleterious environmental effects of this dumping. What can downriver states do? Pretty much nothing. The downriver state could take the upriver state to court, but that doesn't mean anything will change for a number of years as the case winds its way through the court system. By using the Commerce Clause, the federal government basically leveled the playing field and kept downriver states from being victims to upriver state leniencies. So why do we need this law? The Federal Water Pollution Control Act was first enacted in 1948. The federal law established block grants to the states so they could clean up interstate waters, i.e., those that flow between states. Congress enacted the Water Quality Act in 1965 to establish water quality standards that were enforceable. These standards were based on what level of harm was allowable. Supreme Court Justice White explained the background of the act best in the case Environmental Protection Agency versus California, 1976. Before it was amended in 1972, the Federal Water Pollution Control Act employed ambient water quality standards specifying the acceptable levels of pollution in a state's interstate navigable waters as the primary mechanism in its program for the control of water pollution. This program, based on water quality standards, which was to serve both to guide performance by polluters and to trigger legal action to abate pollution, proved ineffective. The problems stem from the character of the standards themselves, which focused on the tolerable effects rather than the preventable causes of water pollution. From the awkwardly shared federal and state responsibility for promulgating such standards, and from the cumbersome enforcement procedures to govern the conduct of individual polluters. Before the 1972 amendments, desired uses of waterways were set by individual states, which classified waterways in categories ranging from Class A for swimming to Class D agricultural and industrial use. Who sees a problem with this? If a state was satisfied that a particular river need only be aesthetically tolerable and fit for commercial navigation, the law did not afford the relief unless the river stank or actually corroded the hulls of ships. One river, the Cuyahoga in Ohio, was not considered legally objectionable until it caught fire in 1969, because the state-designated use of that river was waste disposal. And FYI here, this picture is actually from a different time the Cuyahoga caught fire and has been mislabeled. The Cuyahoga has actually burned four different times. If the harm-based prior law had failed so miserably, why did Congress, in the 1972 amendments, adopt both technology-based and harm-based controls, superimposing a level of water quality-based controls on a fundamental level of technology-based controls? This is where politics comes into play. The Senate favored replacing the water quality-based approach with progressively stricter technology-based effluent limitations, leading to the ultimate cessation of all discharges. The House of Representatives, however, believed that an improved water quality-based approach was still viable. The resulting compromise entails a dual approach, with a harm-based system applicable only where necessary. So the principles of the 1972 amendments. It contained four important principles. The discharge of pollutants into navigable waters is not a right. A discharge permit is required to use public resources for waste disposal and limits the amount of pollution that may be discharged. Wastewater must be treated with the best treatment technology economically achievable, regardless of the condition of the receiving water. And effluent limitations must be based on treatment technology performance, but more stringent limits may be imposed if the technology-based limits do not prevent violations of water quality standards in the receiving water. Now that we know the politics behind the CWA, what was Congress's intent went in and passed the 1972 amendments. Well, we have the Declaration of Goals and Policy, which is found in Title 33 of the United States Code in Section 1251. Pause my recording here and read this. And now we're back. In English, let's look at this. The main intent is to restore the nation's waters. Congress then lists seven objectives. In these objectives are specific dates. 1985, to eliminate all discharges into navigable waters. July 1st, 1983, to have an interim goal of making water safe for wildlife and human recreation. Also note in Objective 3 that toxic pollutants are to be ceased to be dumped in toxic amounts. This means that toxic chemicals can still be dumped, but in lower amounts. Congress also protects states' rights and encouraged the president to encourage other countries to pass their own Clean Water Acts. Even though states can administer the CWA within their borders, the EPA administrator still has the final say. And there is also subsection E, which calls for public participation. One thing to note about the Clean Water Act is that it doesn't cover drinking water. That falls under another law altogether, the Safe Drinking Water Act. The Florida Safe Drinking Water Act is found in Section 403.850, et sequentia. And we'll talk about drinking water in a bit. Okay, so we have the background of this law and what Congress's intent was. Well, at least their stated intent at the time in passing this law. Here is an overview of the types of pollutions we are talking about with the CWA. Industrial, municipal, or agricultural waste, which contribute to increased oxygen consumption, which results in less oxygen for fish and aquatic plant life. Let's think of some local examples of various pollutants. Agricultural, we've got sugar fields. What kind of plants are crowding out the native flora? Cattails. Can anyone think of some place where this is thermal pollution? How about Turkey Point? Do you know what the thermal pollution is used for down there? Any alligators caught in people's lakes, swimming pools, or yards, if not killed, are released there and they love the warm waters. Can anyone come up with a local example of eutrophication? Lake Apopka and Lake Okeechobee is following suit. What about types of fish with heavy metal poisoning, i.e. mercury? We've got swordfish, shark, tuna, a bunch more. So what about Florida law? Well, language parallels the federal law. The Florida Department of Environmental Protection is the body charged with enforcing Florida law. And what aspects of Florida make the CWA such a big deal? Well, take a look at this map of surface water. The CWA is such a big deal to Florida because the entire state is one big aquifer. Something gets pumped into the water in one place, it travels to half of Florida in a short time. So now we have the Florida Air and Water Pollution Control Act. This is Florida Statute Section 403.021, and I've only put in here Sections 1, 2, and 10. Pause and read. And we're back. Note, this policy states that water shall be free of harmful quantities of contaminants. The public possesses no right to be free of all contaminants in their drinking water, just harmful amounts. Contaminants are listed by the Florida Department of Environmental Protection, which must maintain and update the state's list in accordance with the EPA's list of contaminants. If you're interested in FDEP's water quality program, I send you to the Water Quality Assessment Program page. It is interesting to note the differences in these two policy statements. The federal statement is very general, while the state statement is not only very long, but each subsection is concerned with a specific environmental problem. As promised, drinking water. The Safe Drinking Water Act is found in 42 U.S.C. Section 201, et sequentia. The EPA is the agency charged with creating regulations and enforcing the law. The EPA's primary drinking water standards are found at this link. Primary standards must be followed. These are specifically spelled out relating to arsenic, lead, and copper, as well as chemical phase rules. Over 90 contaminants in three contaminant groups, inorganic contaminants, volatile organic contaminants, and synthetic organic contaminants, are included. The EPA also regulates microbial contaminants as well. For more details, see the EPA's webpage and current drinking water regulations at the link. EPA secondary drinking water standards is here. The secondary standards are non-enforceable guidelines, but states may choose to make them enforceable standards. And for more information, see the EPA's background on drinking water standards in the Safe Drinking Water Act page. Now, do the Clean Water Act and Clean Drinking Water Act meet up? On occasion, these laws do intersect. Look back to January 2014. Yeah, I know it's a long time ago, guys, but this is a really good example. Charleston, West Virginia. The governor of West Virginia had to issue a ban on all water usage, not just drinking, but bathing and cooking as well. Freedom Industries kept 14 chemical holding tanks on the Elk River. These tanks stored chemicals from the coal industry. On January 9, 2014, one of the tanks started leaking and spilled up to 10,000 gallons of the chemical 4-methylchlorhexidine methanol. Yeah, I know, I just killed it. The spill occurred upstream from the main water intake of the West Virginia American Water Treatment and Distribution Center. At the time, and still today, we don't know the exact damage this chemical poses to humans and the environment. The chemical, which smells like licorice, can cause headaches, eye and skin irritation, and difficulty breathing from prolonged exposures at high concentrations, according to the American Conference on Governmental Industrial Hygienists. If you're curious about the effects of MCHM, I point you to the direction of ToxNet, Toxicology Data Network, part of the National Library of Medicine at the National Institutes of Health at the given link. We've got drinking water in Florida, right? It depends. The Natural Resources Defense Council issued a report in May 2017 that ranked Florida as the second state in the nation for most reported drinking water violations. I know, guys, it's kind of old, but keep in mind we had COVID. The Environmental Working Group keeps track of contaminants found in tap water. They have created a tap water database that collects mandatory annual test reports from 2014 to 2019 produced by almost 50,000 water utilities in all 50 states and the District of Columbia. The vast majority of the nation's drinking water supplies get a passing grade from federal and state regulatory agencies. However, many of the 250-plus contaminants detected through water sampling and testing are at levels that are perfectly legal under the Safe Drinking Water Act or state regulations, but well above levels authoritative scientific studies have found to pose health risks. Now, you can tell me that back in 2017, but it does not appear that changes have been made in local water systems. In May 2018, the Florida Department of Environmental Protection issued a memo clarifying how local water utilities should be testing their water supplies. This was in response to complaints to the EPA from residents in Wilton Manors that private water testing showed high levels of trihalomethanes and haloacetic acids, known carcinogens. So are we doomed? Not really. Governor Ron DeSantis issued an executive order on January 10, 2019, instructing the Department of Environmental Protection and the Florida Department of Health to take certain actions to enhance Florida's water quality and preserve its natural resources. So the latest thing up to date about drinking water. There is a class of chemicals known as forever chemicals that have been in the news the past few years. In February 2011, the EPA issued information about perchlorate and that it was determining how to regulate these chemicals. The chemicals the EPA was looking at were PFOA, I'm not going to pronounce it, and PFOS, I'm not going to do that one either. They fall into a class called per- and polyfluoroalkyline substances, or PFAS. The EPA stated, June 2020, perchlorate is commonly used in solid rocket propellants, munitions, fireworks, and airbag initiators for vehicles, matches, and signal flares. Perchlorate may occur naturally, particularly in arid regions such as the southwestern U.S., and can be found as a byproduct in hypochlorite solutions used for treating drinking water and nitrate salts used to produce fertilizers, explosives, and other products. Why am I talking about chemicals here when we aren't looking at Fit for Tosca, Rick Red, CERCLA until the second half of the course. Because in February 2020, the EPA announced an action plan to eliminate these chemicals from drinking water. PFAS are a large group of man-made chemicals used in consumer products and industrial processes. In use since the 1940s, PFAS are resistant to heat, oils, stains, grease, and water properties which contribute to their persistence in the environment. On June 18, 2020, the EPA issued another news item. The agency has determined that perchlorate does not meet the criteria for regulation as a drinking water contaminant under the Safe Drinking Water Act. Therefore, the agency is withdrawing the 2011 regulatory determination and is making a final determination to not issue a national regulation on perchlorate at this time. On January 19, 2021, the Environmental Working Group issued a news story, EPA starts long process to set legal limits on forever chemicals in tap water, but action needed now. The story notes, the Environmental Protection Agency took too long overdue preliminary actions towards regulating the toxic forever chemicals known as PFAS in America's tap water, committing to set legal limits for the two most notorious PFAS components and to test public water systems for more than two dozen others. PFAS are known as forever chemicals because they do not break down in the environment and are linked to cancer, reproductive, and developmental harms and reduced effectiveness of vaccines. They contaminate over 2,300 sites in the U.S. The EPA made a final determination to set drinking water limits for PFOA, a PFAS compound once used to make Teflon, and PFOS, a chemical that used to be an ingredient in Scotchgard. This determination is the first step in a long process for setting enforceable nationwide limits. PFOA and PFOS have largely been phased out of commerce, and several states have set their own limits, but the EPA has, for 20-plus years, failed to set a federal standard. The new infrastructure law has provisions regarding PFAS. The Environmental Policy Innovation Center gives a pretty good review of the provisions in the law related to PFAS, in addition to other drinking water issues. EPA's current PFAS roadmap can be found at this link. Hydraulic fracturing. There is still a raging debate over the safety of hydraulic fracturing as it relates to drinking water aquifers. The EPA describes hydraulic fractioning as, hydraulic fracturing produces fractures in the rock formation that stimulate the flow of natural gas or oil, increasing the volumes that can be recovered. Wells may be drilled vertically hundreds to thousands of feet below the land surface and may include horizontal or directional sections extending thousands of feet. Fractures are created by pumping large quantities of fluids at high pressure down a wellbore and into the target rock formation. Hydraulic fracturing fluid consists of water, proppant, which is sand or similar material in a fluid suspension, and chemical additives that open and enlarge fractures within the rock formation. These fractures can extend several hundred feet away from the wellbore. The proppants, sand, ceramic pellets, or other small incompressible particles, hold open the newly created fractures. Once the injection process is completed, the internal pressure of the rock formation causes fluid to return to the surface through the wellbore. This fluid is known as both flowback and produced water, and may contain the injected chemicals plus naturally occurring materials such as brines, metals, radionuclides, and hydrocarbons. The flowback and produced water is typically stored in tanks or pits before treatment, disposal, or recycling. In many cases, it is injected underground for disposal. In areas where that is not an option, it may be treated and reused or processed by a wastewater treatment facility and then discharged to surface water. The EPA developed draft guidance about oil and gas hydraulic fracturing activities using diesel fuels and published it in the Federal Register in May 2012. The comment period on this draft ended in mid-September 2012. In February 2014, the EPA issued a review in response to the comments for this draft. If you want to read this extensive document, you can find it here. It must be noted that fracking has been omitted from being reviewed under the Clean Water Act by the Energy Policy Act of 2005. While hydraulic fracturing may be excluded from the CWA, fracturing operations are under scrutiny through the Underground Injection Control Program. Since underground injection wells are used for aquifer recharging, this means it is part of the Safe Drinking Water Act. So why are we discussing fracking here? Because of the concerns about fracking fluid contaminating groundwater, as well as migrating to the surface. While the concern of migration of the underground water is most prevalent, evidence so far indicates that mismanagement of the wastewater is a greater threat. That's Eric Giles from the New York Times. The EPA has initiated studies on fracking impact on drinking water. For a full review of their current research, there is the study of hydraulic fracturing for oil and gas and its potential impact on drinking water resources. In February 2017, researchers from a number of universities and government agencies published a study analyzing 6,648 identified spills reported across Colorado, New Mexico, North Dakota, and Pennsylvania during a 10-year period. If you're really interested, the full report can be found here at the Environmental Science and Technology publication. Is there fracking here in Florida? In Florida legislative sessions since 2016, bills banning fracking in Florida failed to be enacted. The latest attempt was in January of 2021, and the 2022 Florida legislature included a bill filed by Florida Senator Gary M. Farmer Jr., Democrat, called the Stop Fracking Act, SB 208. In March 2022, the Florida Senate described the bill as indefinitely postponed and withdrawn from consideration and died in Environmental and Natural Resources Committee. In 2014, the Dan A. Hughes Company drilled an experimental acid fracking well in Collier County, just outside of the borders to the Florida Panther National Wildlife Refuge. The Florida Department of Environmental Protection issued a cease and desist order, and the Dan A. Hughes Company paid a $25,000 fine and installed groundwater monitoring equipment. In 2016, the acid well was again in the news over allegations that the company had dumped oil waste into the well illegally instead of properly disposing it. Tests performed by the contractor overseeing the closing of the well site found no evidence that drinking water in an aquifer near the site was affected. So let's look at some definitions here. We got 9 on the federal side right here. BAT means best available technology economically achievable. BAT is to be implemented for pollutants identified in Table 1 of Committee Print numbered 95-30 of the Committee on Public Works and Transportation of the House of Representatives. All toxic pollutants listed under Paragraph 1 of Subsection A of Section 307 and for all other pollutants not mentioned earlier in this act. Yeah, I know. Gotta love the definitions, guys. BCT. In the 1977 amendments, the BAT requirements were modified for conventional pollutants to a new standard requiring the best conventional pollutant control technology. BCT was to be achieved by July 1, 1984, and this was later extended to 1989. BPT means best practicable control technology currently available. This phrase is located in Section 301B1A. Please note, it applies to all point sources except for publicly owned treatment works. What BPT is to be defined by the EPA administrator according to Section 304B. BPT to limit effluent was to be put into place on all point sources no later than July 1, 1977. Effluent limitations are any restriction established by a state or the administrator of EPA on quantities, rates, and concentrations of chemical, physical, biological, or other constituents which are discharged from point sources, including schedules of compliance. We have a new source, means any source the construction of which is commenced after the publication of proposed regulations prescribing a standard of performance under this section, which shall be applicable to such source if such standard is thereafter promulgated in accordance with this section. NPDES means National Pollutant Discharge Elimination System, found in Section 402. It gives the administrator or the state the authority to issue permits allowing discharges of a single pollutant or combination of pollutants. We have a point source, which is any discernible, confined, and discrete conveyance from which pollutants are or may be discharged. A source means any building, structure, facility, or installation from which there is or may be the discharge of pollutants. This is one of my favorite test questions because I require you to put in building, structure, facility, or installation. TMDL means total maximum daily load. This standard is used when both technology-based effluent limitations and water quality-based limitations are not enough to abate the severity of the current pollution problem. So what are some Florida definitions? We have contaminant, means any substance which is harmful to plant, animal, or human life. Effluent limitations means any restrictions established by the department on quantities, rates, or concentrations of chemical, physical, biological, or other constituents which are discharged from sources into waters of the state. Pollution means the presence in the outdoor atmosphere or waters of the state of any substances, contaminants, noise, or man-made or human-induced impairment of air or waters, or alteration of the chemical, physical, biological, or radiological integrity of air or water in quantities or at levels which are or may be potentially harmful or injurious to human health or welfare, animal or plant life, or property, or which unreasonably interfere with the enjoyment of life or property, including outdoor recreation, unless authorized by applicable law. Source means any and all points of origin of the item defined in subsection 1, i.e. contaminant, whether privately or publicly owned or operated. TMDL means the sum of the individual waste load allocations for point sources and the load allocations for non-point sources and natural background. Prior to determining individual waste load allocations and load allocations, the maximum amount of a pollutant that a water body or water segment can assimilate from all sources without exceeding water quality standards. According to FDEP, if new information becomes available, a TMDL can undergo a reevaluation within 5 years of its adoption. Now, the Florida definitions are a bit more specific than the federal definitions, don't you think? Effluent limitations in the federal law cover three sections of the law and go through a litany of specifics explaining how they are calculated, what types of sources they apply to, and what technology to use. There is no simple definition as the Florida law has. Also note that the definition for source refers back to the definition for contaminant. Does anyone think this is odd? So Section 301 effluents. Section 301A makes it unlawful to discharge any pollutant into the waters of the United States except as provided in Section 302, 306, 307, 318, 402, and 404 of the Clean Water Act. Section 301B sets out the limitations of how much stuff a point source, excluding publicly owned treatment works, can discharge into navigable waters. This is the technology-based limitation the Senate wanted. Section 301C, the administrator may modify the requirements of sections B to A of this section with respect to any point source for which a permanent application is filed after July 1st of 1977 upon a showing by the owner or operator of such point source satisfactory to the administrator that such modified requirements, one, represents the maximum use of technology within the economic capability of the owner or operator, and two, will result in reasonable further progress towards the elimination of the discharge of pollutants. So, in order to get a permit, it has to be an existing source. The owner-operator must try their best to implement BAT, but cost considerations can be taken into account. The operator can't do nothing and has to do something, but if BAT would bankrupt the point source, there is some wiggle room. Now, Florida law has its permit allowance in Section 403.06114. It requires the DEP to establish a permit system whereby a permit may be required for the operation, construction, or expansion of any installation that may be a source of air or water pollution, and provide for the issuance and revocation of such permits and for the posting of an appropriate bond to operate. Note that in the Florida law, to get a variance permit, the operator has to put up a bond. This is determined on a case-by-case basis, depending on the type of pollution and what the calculations are for possible cleanup costs. CWA Section 302, Water Quality-Related Effluent Limitations. This section gives the EPA administrator the ability to control stricter effluent limitations on a single point source of group or point sources where the water quality will not attain the standards the government is looking for within the time frame specified. This is the water quality-based standard the House wanted. So CWA Section 303, Water Quality Standards and Implementation Plans. Pause to read. And we're back. This section gives the administrator the authority to set total maximum daily loads. So let's look at TMDLs in Florida. In furtherance of public policy established in Section 403.021, the legislature declares, I'm pausing, you can read, and we're back. Please note the underlining. Implementation of the allocation shall include consideration of a cost-effective approach coordinated between contributing point and non-point sources of pollution for impaired water bodies or water body segments, and may include the opportunity to implement the allocation through non-regulatory and incentive-based programs. This is very interesting. Not only does this section establish a TMDL program, but it also says that the state is looking at cost effectiveness in any approach, as well as have industry and agriculture take the lead instead of the state having to regulate all TMDL programs. It's a carrot program. So TMDL in Florida, for example. In 2001, a TMDL for the Lake Okeechobee was adopted. The TMDL proposed an annual load of 140 metric tons of phosphorus to Lake Okeechobee. The goal to achieve an in-lake target phosphorus concentration of 40 parts per billion in the pelagic zone, i.e. the water column, not the bottom, of the lake. Goal of restoration target to support a healthy lake system, restore the designated uses of Lake Okeechobee, and allow the lake to meet applicable water quality standards. Now, in water year 2021, the South Florida Water Management District reported that in water year 2021, the in-lake TP concentration was 147 micrograms per liter, 5% higher than the water year 2020 value of 141 micrograms per liter. These in-lake TP concentration values exceeded the TP in-lake goal of 40 micrograms per liter. The report goes on, the total phosphorus TP load to Lake Okeechobee was 520 metric tons in water year 2021, which includes an estimated 35 tons from atmospheric deposition, a 60% increase from water year 2020. The most recent five-year average TP load was 571 tons, which exceeded the lake's total maximum daily load by 431 tons. Thought question, what would you do? Tighten environmental law restrictions? More money to stop phosphorus loading? Impose penalties? Revise the TMDL? The latter was being discussed in 2018. Does anyone think that this might be a little like lowering the bar to be met? Alternative regulatory permitting. The Department of Environmental Protection is directed to explore alternatives to traditional methods of regulatory permitting, provided that such alternative methods will not allow a material increase in pollution emissions or discharges. Working with industry, business associations, other government agencies, or interested parties, the department is directed to consider specific limited pilot projects to test new compliance measures. These measures should include, but not be limited to, reducing transaction costs for business and government and providing economic incentives for emission reductions. Florida Statute 403.0611. This is interesting, because it is trying to keep costs down for both industry and the government. But note that the pilot programs are to be specific and limited. So let's revisit the principles of the 72 Amendment. The wastewater has to be treated to the best treatment technology economically achievable, regardless of the condition of the receiving water. So what's the potential problems with technology-based approach?
Well, we've got industrial lobbying, the data reliability, loopholes for what counts as data, and one technology may result in different end-of-pipe numbers depending on the circumstances. So what do? Use best performance numbers to determine? Perhaps revisit the U.S. House's intent of WQBells? Well, we've got the South Florida Water Treatment Wetlands, the STAs. These have gotten below 20 parts per billion in total phosphorus discharge before. They're currently performing around 50 parts per billion for assorted reasons. And the Everglades need 16 to 17 parts per billion flow-weighted mean concentrations in STA discharges. Note, this continues to be a large area of disagreement, with a lot of scientific, political, and legal attention to being paid to where this heads. So are there Florida permit loopholes? Where and how would you try and find them? What counts as a discharge or not? So polluted water moving through canals in South Florida does not count if part of the water supply deliveries, i.e. not intended for environment. We also have climate extremes, the force majeure, hurricanes. See the Legal Information Institute about force majeure. And then rain outside of average conditions. So flood, guys. Flood protection trumps environmental protection. Here's a bellwether case from 1977. It means fundamentally critical. Title III of the CWA gives a lot of power to the EPA administrator. Let's look at the EI DuPont de Nemours and Company case. In this case, EI DuPont de Nemours and Company filed three lawsuits, which boiled down to three issues before the U.S. Supreme Court, of which we're only interested in two here. And yeah, I know, I keep saying this the French way. I took French if you couldn't tell. Set up, eight chemical companies didn't like EPA's new authority on discharge of pollutants. So the legal issues brought to the U.S. Supreme Court were whether the EPA had authority under Section 301 to issue industry-wide regulations limiting effluent discharges for existing plants. And the third issue is whether the new source standards issued under Section 306 must allow variances for individual plants, i.e. looking for those loopholes. Issue 1. The court looked to the congressional record and found the Senate report stated that pursuant to subsection 301b1a and section 304b, the administrator is to set a base level for all plants in a given category, and in no case should any plant be allowed to discharge more pollutants per unit of production than is defined by that base level. Therefore, the court held that the EPA had authority under Section 301 to issue regulations setting forth uniform effluent limitations for categories of plants. The court noted that while the EPA had authority to issue base level limitations under Section 301, Section 304 required that the guidelines survey the practical or available pollution control technology for an industry and assess its effectiveness, and then describe the methodology the EPA intends to use in the 301 regulations to determine the effluent limitations for particular plants. This is known as the variance clause. So the variance is a case-specific exemption or change in part of how a regulation is applied. Chemical companies lost this one. Issue 3. The court looked to the congressional record and found that Congress intended these regulations to be absolute prohibitions. In striking contrast to 301C, there is no statutory provision for variances, and a variance provision could be inappropriate in a standard that was intended to ensure national uniformity and maximum feasible control of new sources. Chemical companies lost this one, too. Looking at the DuPont case, the Supreme Court basically said that Congress intended to give the EPA administrator a lot of power and flexibility. One thing to note about the administrator's regulatory power is that all effluent limitations have to apply evenly across the United States. The EPA adopted a categorical approach to setting technology-based effluent limitations. Industries were divided into categories based on products manufactured and subcategories based on processes or raw materials utilized in producing products, e.g. the dredging mining subcategory of the placer mining category. Then the BPT and BAT criteria were applied to these categories and subcategories, not to individual plants. The EPA's effluent limitation regulations for each individual subcategory contained maximum daily and monthly average limitations on relevant parameters, pollutants, expressed in terms of maximum volume of wastewater or concentration of parameters in wastewater per unit of production or other measure of output. These single-number effluent limitations were uniform for existing plants in a particular subcategory, wherever they are located. EPA cannot establish a subcategory based solely on geographical location. Section 306, National Standards of Performance. As defined in this section, standard of performance means a standard for the control of the discharge of pollutants, which reflects the greatest degree of effluent reduction, which the administrator determines to be achievable through application of the best available demonstrated control technology, processes, operating methods, or other alternatives, including, where practicable, a standard permitting no discharge of pollutants. So after the effective date of standards of performance promulgated under this section, it shall be unlawful for any owner or operator of any new source to operate such source in violation of any standard of performance applicable to such source. So we have Section 307, Toxic and Pretreatment Effluent Standards. The list of toxic chemicals is found at 40 CFR Section 401.15. It was originally published as Table 1 of Committee Print numbered 95-30 of the Committee on Public Works and Transportation of the House of Representatives. 95th Congress was in session from January 77 to January 79. So at least we don't have to go through digging through the congressional record. We actually have it in the Code of Federal Regulations. Any effluent standards for toxic chemicals are to be reviewed every 3 years. Any effluent standard promulgated under Section 307 must provide an ample margin of safety as determined by the administrator. So the 1972 Act's toxic pollutant control mechanism was a cumbersome pollutant-by-pollutant harm-based system that resulted in little control of toxic water pollutants. Rejecting this exercise in futility, the EPA decided to regulate toxic pollutants primarily through BAT-based effluent limitations. This decision was upheld in a consent decree in 1976, National Resources Defense Council versus Train, 8 ERC 2120. This decree established timetables for EPA to promulgate effluent limitations based on BAT for 21 industrial categories covering 65 families of compounds, which EPA has broken down into 129 primary pollutants. EPA can add toxic pollutants to this list by regulation. Congress codified this methodology in sections 301B2C and 307A1 and 2 in the 1977 amendments. It should be noted that the EPA has not added any primary pollutants or industrial categories to its lists since the 1976 consent decree. And the next class will be on Part 2 of the Clean Water Act.